CB Shocking Jazz.
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet. I mean, clap your heads. Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
Live from the CRN studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, this is Racing Through History.
Hello, race fans. Welcome to this edition of the Goat Rodeo. My name is Jeff Gilder, and I'll be the host. I've got a little bit of housekeeping to do here around the studio and get folks hooked up and all that kind of stuff, get the embed up. So I'm going to turn this over to the rest of the goats. Y'all take it away.
All right. I'll be the goat number one. Welcome to Racing Through History, a.k.a. the Goat Rodeo all over again. And I want to talk a little bit about, sadly, an issue that we've the racing community's been dealing with for the last couple of weeks, and that is the locally here at Myrtle Beach Speedway, Myrtle Beach racing community, the Terry Evans, Justin Milliken tragic accident, and the loss of Terry Evans. The Myrtle Beach Speedway this coming Saturday night, August the 12th, which was originally scheduled as Bell and Bell night, and it's still Bell and Bell night. But in addition to that, it's going to be the Terry Evans night also, with proceeds hopefully being raised and to help offset some of the expenses from this tragedy. As Jack was pointing out, and I was not aware of this over the weekend, the cars race at Hickory, and what was it? Just a regular race at Greenville Pickens?
As far as I know, it's just a regular race at Greenville Pickens. But Steve Zacharias from Myrtle Beach was at Hickory, and they raised roughly $4,500. Steve going through the grandstand for Terry Evans to help with funeral expenses. And at the same night at Greenville Pickens, I don't know who was there, but they raised about $5,000 for the Terry Evans.
That is unbelievable. That is just so incredible. $9,000 from both of those tracks, hundreds of miles away from here, just gives you an indication of the racing family, the close-knit brotherhood.
Yep.
So that's really something.
And for those of you that don't know who Terry Evans is, Bobby, why don't you explain who Terry was?
Terry Evans was he was a young man. He was from the Shalhoub area, actually.
Hello.
Was 35, or he was born in 1981, and I remember Terry racing go karts at Shalhoub Point when he was about 12, and he's been involved in some kind of racing ever since then, through the kart ranks. He started racing mini stocks at Myrtle Beach and worked his way up to to late models. He has a late model, him and his dad. And his dad, while Terry was becoming a driver, Terry's dad, who is Terry Sr., Terry Sr. was always called Bimbo. We knew him as, he was just known as Bimbo. He was actually in my grade in school. And Little Terry, or Terry Jr., sometimes was called Little Bo or Bo, but they both had the same name and the same nickname. But his father began to be a pretty accomplished engine builder of late model stock engines there at Myrtle Beach. Terry Evans Sr. built some very competitive engines, some fast ones, and one cool thing about that, it was truly a backyard operation. It was nothing fancy, no big shop, no big equipment, just very hands-on, low tech, just being smart and doing what you could with what you had. And somewhere in the last few years, what was that?
I just said thank you for reconnecting me.
Oh, okay.
You didn't have to say that. Go ahead.
Terry decided he wanted to focus on being a crew chief more than he did a driver. And he and Justin Milliken, who had been friends since their high school days, was able to, you know, they got connected and teamed up, and it became a very successful relationship on the racetrack and off the track. They were good friends, and they were solid teammates. And this year, one of Terry's neighbors was having some issues with a super truck that they were running there at Myrtle Beach, and he asked Terry to help him out some. And Terry had drove some and worked on it a little bit. As a matter of fact, he won the last time that, I guess it was, they had a truck race at Myrtle Beach. Terry Evans won the race in Andy Clemens' truck, the number 38 truck. And no one knew that would be the last time for everything. But that was Terry won that race, and so Terry was a very big part of Justin Milliken Racing and a huge part of the success. He was just a great crew chief and understood the setup on race cars very good, in addition to being a very competent driver himself. And they had been at Myrtle Beach on that Friday, I think it was July the 21st. They were down at the track practicing, which was very common for them. They would always they never went to a race, you know, cold cock, so to speak. They had practiced ahead of time. They had been down practicing on the Friday for the Saturday night race, and when they were coming back home, the accident occurred. So that's kind of brings us up to the moment. The funeral for Terry was this past Sunday, back at Mount Olive Baptist Church in Supply. So, you know, as you might expect, it was a sad but special occasion. So Terry, you know, he will be missed, but that just shows you how far and how connected the racing world is. So we're looking forward to Saturday night, and you know, to race and gather, you know, in his honor. So, you know, any race fans in the area, if you want to come out and be a part of this effort, I think it's going to be a big turnout, don't you, Jack?
I would think so. Yep. And Steve Zacharias from Myrtle Beach is really pushing the Racing Brotherhood, and this is their event is trying to help the Evans family out.
Well, you know, you can imagine medical reality being what it is. Right. You can imagine the bills incurred in a hospital stay like that. This situation, it's going to be legally complicated. I don't know what the insurance capacity of the other car who was at fault. I don't know what that's going to be, if anything.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a lot more questions than answers at this point. But, you know, but if you want to help, all finances, you know, will be appreciated. So it can definitely go somewhere and will be needed somewhere. So come on out if you can support it. There's other ways, you know, you can contribute, but you know, the Terry Evans event and the Bell and Bell night is this Saturday night, so hopefully
so
the
Bell
weather will be
Bell
good.
Bell and Bell is running Saturday night at Myrtle Beach.
Well, it is it's Bell and Bell night. That doesn't, and that's slightly different than Bell and Bell Vintage.
It's complicated.
It's complicated, real complicated.
Boy, don't complicate me tonight.
But we'll have cars there.
The Bell and Bell cars will be there.
Yeah, Bell and Bell cars will be there running our own little race. We're a bunch of fish out of water. We're some old dirt guys trying to run on a super speedway, so that ought to be worth admission to see that.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we're going to be there, and so then, you know, that'll fill up the house right there. But I'll tell you what, at Terry's service Sunday afternoon, The Myrtle Beach Speedway officials all came, and you know the track chaplain and his staff, and they that was a really special effort. That really did speak well and speak volumes. The Speedway chaplain was part of the helped conduct the service. So that's really cool.
Yep. And of course, on another front, we also lost Little Bud Moore this past week, and unfortunately, he passed away. But as they say, he's in a better place now. So he was a frequent visitor on this show back in our early years, and a good friend of many of us.
Yeah, but Little Bud was he was a character. He was the epitome of what we all love and love to talk about. The old days, the real old days. He was certainly from that era and knew all the players, or a lot of them. Yep. Used to say, if Leroy Yarborough was riding with you in a car, every time you stopped at a stoplight, he'd jump out.
Want to fight somebody.
Fight somebody on the sidewalk.
He must have been some kin to Bill Tripp.
Yeah, even if he lost, he just wanted to fight somebody on the sidewalk. Most of the time, it would be Tiny Lund if he was anywhere in the area. But and on the Little Bud front, of course, Little Bud contracted ALS disease not too often. I mean, I guess recently, but you don't have a lot of time sometimes when that happens. But we're going to have the Vintage Cars. Our Vintage Group is going to have a special race at Lakeview's Carolina Speedway on Labor Day Saturday night. And there might be a lot of stuff going on that, but there's no racing. There's absolutely no racing anywhere in our area on Labor Day Saturday except at Lakeview. And this is the first time they've raced this year, and they've asked us to be part of it. We're excited. We're looking forward to it. And we've named our event the Little Bud Moore Memorial Vintage Classic, I think is our official name, but it commemorates. Because Lakeview is exactly the type of track that Little Bud, he came from. That was him. So that's something that's coming up on Labor Day Saturday. So, all right. All right, Jeff, you got everything lined out?
Pretty much so, yeah. Yeah, I was just listening to you guys. That was good coverage of all that. Thank you very much. Cody, are you there?
I am.
Okay, first time I got a chance to verify that. He's in. For some reason, when Cody comes on Skype, I have to dump everybody else and put Cody on first. I think he's just somewhere in the Skype world, he holds a special place.
Yeah, I think he does.
He's number one. He's got to be first.
Well, just don't let him say it's the Russians.
All right, question is that because he's calling?
I think there's collusion there.
Doesn't matter. I don't know. I usually can add people when they call in. I don't know what it is with his. When he calls in, I don't have the option to add him to the group. It's either dump it or nothing. I don't know why that is. My guess is it's probably somewhere in Cody's Skype settings, but. Anyway, we get it. All right, who's up next?
Yeah, I done talked enough.
Well, let Cody go.
Yeah, let Cody go.
Hello, Cody.
Hello, Jeff.
Cody, go.
Well, I don't mean to be first in everything. I guess just
of course
in Skype
you do.
Calls.
But you never apologize for being first, sir.
Yeah, if you ain't first, you're last.
That's right.
So, I found this article that I wrote on September the 13th, 2011. So that definitely wasn't yesterday. So I just kind of wanted to go over it again if we got some time.
We do. Let's do it. Yeah.
Well, I hope it ain't too long, but this is called The Most Influential Cars in Georgia Racing History. So cars in history are like bread and butter. They just have to be together. And for the history in the state of Georgia, automobiles are very important. In the days when you knew what a car was by just looking at the headlights, one was something to be proud of, even sometimes sacred. And in automobile racing throughout the South, cars were better than trophies and cash. From the beginning of stock car racing, there have been cars that have been favored for different reasons. In this article, I read several cars for both NASCAR and in Georgia, of my opinion, that earns a place on this timeline. First, which probably everybody could agree on, would be the 1939 Ford Coupe. Some might say the 40, but looking through all the pictures and videos from, you know, that time period around pre-war and post-war racing, most were the 1939 Standard Coupe models. Rated horsepower from the factory was either 60 or the optional 85 horsepower flathead. But once master mechanics such as Red Vogt got a hold of such a car, it could turn close to a whopping 140 horsepower. This car could run everywhere, not just around Georgia, as they were cheap to buy and cheap to buy speed parts for. The next car in line, of my opinion, would be the between the 1949 to the 53 Oldsmobile Rocket 88. It was favored because the lines in the rocket motor that could be modified, and like the 39 Ford, could be found relatively easily for the time period. Lots of racers had these cars, like Gober Sosby, Red Byron, the Flock brothers, and the Oldsmobiles would have had more wins in the early 50s if it wasn't for the Hudson Hornet. Speaking of which, the Hornet would have been on this list, but other than NASCAR, the Georgia drivers from the day didn't really drive Hudsons that much. The next car, which is still to this day a favorite, is the 55 Chevy. Yeah. It was the first year for the small block V8 for the GM company. Believe it or not, it took Chevy from 1948 till 55 to get its first win in NASCAR Grand National, owned by Frank Christian, who was a Dahlonega native, which is just above us in Dawsonville. And it was driven by Fonnie Flock at Columbia, South Carolina. The 55 was used heavily not only in NASCAR but all over Georgia tracks, even up until the mid 70s, and still today. If I could be wrong, Bobby, but you know I've seen a lot of vintage race cars that have been redone as 55 Chevy.
Yeah, you are not wrong. That is one of the most popular cars in the history of all time.
Yep,
without a doubt, it's right up there with the 39 Ford.
The next car on my list would be the 61 through the 64 Ford Galaxy. Even though those years are very different looks-wise, I believe they were used heavily both in NASCAR and on the weekly circuits. One especially would be the 1963 Galaxy hardtop fastback. You know, it was very dominant in NASCAR, and it tracks like Lakewood, you know, at the time. I know you had a lot running in Augusta, even to the mid to late 60s. So around here in Georgia, it was a pretty successful car, seemed like. The next car on my list would be the mid-60s Chevrolet Nova, or the Chevy 2. This car is a little different from any other car before, because it's a relatively smaller car, which came a few years after the compact car craze, including the Falcon, and what I used to have known them as... the Valiant. Remember that? Yeah.
Yeah, the Valiant. We was referring to that recently.
And since the Nova was a relatively small car, that meant it was lightweight, and small block motors, usually 350s, were easy to find parts for. Fairly simple to modify. This car never really ran a NASCAR, but some say it was just as successful as the 39 Ford was on the short tracks. Now, down in Georgia, the guys like Buck Simmons, Hank Grillett, Leon Sales, Charlie Mincy, Mike Head, they all had Novas for this time. They were just the go-to car for that time period in the early 70s. The main competitor for the Nova was the Falcon, which is also also won almost equal amounts of wins thanks to the likes of Jody Ridley and Bill Elliott in Georgia. This car was typically ran up until the mid-late 70s when the late model Camaro fad took over. Now, to make the Mopar folks happy, I do believe that both the Dodge Dart and the Charger throughout the late 60s were tough to beat. Even though those were two totally different cars, to me they fall in the same category. Dart was mildly successful running against the Falcon and the Nova. The Charger could really put on a show at the big tracks for the Grand Nationals. Both winged and regular versions of the Charger really tore up Atlanta International, Macon, Middle Georgia, and Jeffco, which is now defunct. It was known as the Gresham Motorsports Park, and it shut down a few years ago. Charger with the big wing on the back was called Daytona, and that's what won the 1970 Grand National Championship. Now, a lot of GM guys are probably wondering why I'm leaving out the 67 through the 69 Camaro, the first generation of their version of the pony car. I just feel that era of the Camaro was used mainly for road racing, in more professional series like the Grand Am, NASCAR's Pony Car Series. But I decided to add yet another Chevy to the product. The second generation Camaro, which is 1970 through, I believe, 81 or 82. I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but really all over the South in the late 70s, you could find a second generation Camaro in the late model division. You know, especially right when the NDRA started up in the late 70s, I feel like there were so many Camaros that was pretty much outnumbered everything else. Everybody, it was almost like an IROC series. Everybody ran that style of Camaro. Let's see. Sorry, I lost my place. Another car I think was influential to Georgia racing history, at least, and you'll kind of see why here in a second, was the Aero era of the Thunderbird, Ford Thunderbird, lasting from 1983 to 1988. Throughout this span, the car was redesigned only once with a different front end. The car wasn't used much on short track racing, as it was in NASCAR, however. But to tie in with Georgia racing history, we've got Mr. Bill Elliott. His first win in a new Thunderbird didn't come until the summer of 1984 at Michigan. Drove a red and white number 9 sponsored by Coors. He did win one time in 83, but that was with an older model car. The Bird got two more wins from Bill that year, along with many other drivers. But 1985 was the big year for both Bill Elliott and his Thunderbird. Together for that year, they won 11 wins on the super speedways, plus a $1 million bonus for winning 3 out of the 4 major races that year. He would lose the championship that year, however, to Darrell Waltrip. In 87, Bill and his T-Bird earned yet another Daytona 500 victory, setting the speed record there and the Talladega record that same year. Not only did the 212.809 mile-an-hour lap set the Talladega record, but it also is the holding NASCAR record. The next year, 1988, Elliott won the Winston Cup Championship in the Coors number 9 Ford. And also around that time, you notice a lot of teams that were switching from Buick, Oldsmobile, Pontiac, that kind of stuff. A lot of them did go to the Fords in the late 90s. That was about the last of the real new cars that raced. Everything nowadays in both dirt late models and NASCAR are obviously fiberglass replicas, and you know, nowadays even carbon fiber, expensive and lightweight. I'd still be inclined to say that the Ford Pinto would be on the list, since it's still a favorite for the pony stock division at most short tracks, around here at least. I can't bring myself to put on this list. So anyway, I wrote this back in 2011, so just doing a search today for something to talk about, and came across that, so I thought, why not? So
I think it was great.
Brings back lots of memories.
Yeah, it does. Enjoyed it.
There's a lot of cars that we could add to it. And, you know, a lot of cars I kind of feel different about now. I'm surprised I didn't put anything about a Chevelle. You know, but at least for this part of the country in Georgia, just looking back on all the history, I feel like those are some of the, like I said, the most influential cars. Especially, like I said, you had the 39 Fords. Pre-post-war cars. You had the 55 Chevrolets that raced for 10, 15 years after they came out, and the Novas and the Falcons, and especially those later Camaros in the late 70s. And to me, you know, you look at the old dirt track pictures and even asphalt from the late 70s, early 80s, they were just all Camaros, it seemed like.
The Georgia guys, really, that is their signature car. They invented that whole type of racing, that car, that everything, the NDRA style car.
And now a lot, thinking about too, a lot of drivers, even into the early 70s, still use the 55 Chevrolet frames. And a lot I've heard about was 56 Ford frames for the Ford cars and 55 Chevrolet. They put a newer body on it, but you know, they still use the old chassis.
The engine was behind the front axle was the advantage in a 55 Chevrolet. It didn't straddle the axle line. It was behind it.
It was all every bit of it was behind,
behind the
engine. Center line of the front axle.
Yep, that was huge. A Chevelle had a cross member and the motor straddled the center line.
But when you're building cars like that, how much leeway do you have to set the motor back on a Chevelle chassis? I guess it depends on the rules.
Well, they yeah. Well, there used to be a rule. It was like 1 inch. The left front spark plug could be 1 inch. Back of the ball joint, something like that.
So, yeah, there was
So there was a limit to what you could do. But that was the problem with the Chevelle chassis, was it the motor was so far forward.
Yeah.
As compared to the 55.
Now, one thing, Mike Head here in Georgia, he ran a Corvair for a lot of years. Of course, he had the engine in the front, but apparently it was a really good car. I believe he did run a 55 Chevy frame on it, though.
The Corvair bodies were big in mid-North Carolina for a number of years. I guess they were easy to mount on whatever chassis you had.
Yeah, they were about the same wheelbase.
But they sure made an ugly race car.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, they weren't much to write home about.
I like those Gremlins. Yeah. Same thing.
Well, that's all I got, folks.
That was good, Cody.
That was very good. Jack, take it away.
All right. Well, for the Carolina Race Place historic race finish tonight, we are going to none other than Columbia Speedway. Columbia Speedway held a 100-lap late model sportsman race on Thursday night, July 9th, 1964. The race was about halfway through the 1964 season at the half-mile clay track. At that point in the season, Dink Widenhouse, Ralph Earnhardt, Leroy Yarborough, and Joe Penlin had won two races each. Sam Smith won three races, and Bud Moore got his first 1964 Columbia victory the previous week. The 100-lapper started with Joe Penlin on the pole because of winning the heat race. Penlin led the first seven laps before developing fuel problems, putting him out of the race. At that point, Ned Setzer of Cherryville, North Carolina, took over the lead position, driving a 1955 Chevrolet. The caution flag waved on lap 23 when David Shealy of Batesburg lost control, coming out of the fourth turn. Shealy's 1956 Chevrolet spun out, lost a wheel, then hit the guardrail backwards in front of the grandstand. The wheel rolled into the infield, giving a spectator a minor injury. Six laps later, the race returned to green. Setzer was still in the lead, but little Bud Moore of Charleston, South Carolina, was challenging Setzer lap after lap. Finally, on lap 47, Moore cleared Setzer, putting his number 9 white 1957 Chevrolet in the lead. Moore held the lead the rest of the way to the checkered flag on lap 100. Moore won $500 for the victory. This was Moore's second win of the 1964 season at Columbia. Bud Moore would end up having a total of three wins at Columbia in 1964, and he became the 1964 track champion. During Bud Moore's career, he would also visit Victory Lane in Columbia 27 times between 1963 and 1969. So here's the way they finished 100-lapper Columbia Speedway, July 9th, 1964. The winner driving the number 9, Bud Moore, Charleston, South Carolina, in a 57 Chevrolet, followed by the number 7 of Ned Setzer, Cherryville, North Carolina, 55 Chevrolet, Sam Smith, Union, South Carolina, 55 Chevrolet, Dink Widenhouse, Concord, North Carolina, in a 56 Ford owned by Marion Cox. Finishing fifth, Joe Penlin, Casey, South Carolina, 55 Chevrolet, Bill Oswald, Leesville, South Carolina, a 56 Ford, Jack Rogers, Greenville, South Carolina, a 55 Chevy, Cale Yarborough, Sardis, South Carolina, a 56 Ford, Jim Taylor, Owens, South Carolina, a 57 Chevy. Coming in 10th, Frank Brantley, Savannah, Georgia, a 61 Plymouth, George Whitaker, Lexington, South Carolina, a 55 Chevy, Bubba Into, Hardeeville, South Carolina, a 55 Chevy, Cecil Gunther, Batesburg, South Carolina, a 56 Ford. Coming in 14th, the The number 55 of Tiny Lund Cross, South Carolina, a 61 Ford. David Shealy, Batesburg, South Carolina, a 56 Chevy. Frank Warren, Augusta, Georgia, a 61 Pontiac. Bubba Farr, Augusta, Georgia, a 56 Ford. And coming in 18th in the final car, Possum Jones, Tampa, Florida, a 58 Ford. So that's the way they finished July 9th, 1964.
You know one thing wrong with racing now is we don't have anybody named Possum anymore.
I know. No Possums, no Bubbas.
Yeah. Yeah.
No Dicks.
Right. I mean, what's
no
the word?
No Dick Trickle.
No Possums. So.
What's that, think, Bobby? Like, I see you looking at my list. You anything you spot?
You know, in 1964, Cale Yarborough was not exactly a superstar.
Nope.
He was a budding superstar.
Yep.
But he hadn't really hit his stride yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure whose car he was driving. If that was his, the 56 Ford.
It might have been the preacher's car.
No, the preacher might have had two of them. Dink was in the 56
that's right.
Ford.
Now, somewhere along in this same time span is the famous race that Dink and Ralph Earnhardt get in a wreck together and go off the track and both retire on the spot.
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah, it's a little bit later, 65 or 66, I think.
Well, Ralph don't retire, but Dink does.
Yeah. And who took over that car after Dink retired out of the Marion Cox car? But Bud Moore, I believe.
He was in there for a little while.
Yeah.
Sure. I didn't realize that. Also, this 1964... This was in July. Little Bud would start the Southern 500 that year in a car with his helmet not latched on properly. When they took the green flag, his helmet spun around in front of his eyes, is what he said. He drove the first half of the race with the helmet unhooked.
Yeah, it looked like Bud raced limited sportsman, the sportsman division, late model sportsman at Columbia from 63 to 69. But prior to that, he actually started in 58, I believe, at King Street, at the Black River Speedway in King Street, South Carolina. And then he was the Georgia state champion in the limited sportsman division in 1962. So he was kind of working his way up and got his break in Grand National about the same time, about 64. And then kind of raced back and forth between sportsman and Grand National for a few years and retired.
Yeah. Little Bud, he was a colleague of these guys. He was in the same time frame as Cale and that whole group, that whole class. He was one of them. He, you know, I obviously the brakes didn't go quite his way that some of them got. So, but he was in there.
Yep.
He, you know, could have been.
Another one of the ones that came along with all that bunch that I heard you mention in there in that lineup was Frank Warren.
Yep.
I bet you that was an old Grand National car, 61
Pontiac.
Yep.
And that 61 Plymouth that Frank Brantley had, that might have been an old Grand National
car. Most likely. Because that's what happened back then with the Grand National cars. They kind of came down the ladder to the sportsman.
Yeah, they became hand-me-downs, which I thought always was a really good system. Why throw away a three-year-old car?
Yep.
Yeah. That system certainly is out of vogue now.
Yep.
Nobody can use them. Although, just not really related to that, but kind of related, I saw in Shalot at Jerome Steakhouse a couple of weeks ago a Chevrolet SS. Actually, that's the car that supposedly NASCAR races now. It's the first one I had ever seen, ever. But it was a street version of that car, and it sort of looked like it. But. So anyway, one does exist in the world, and I have seen it. In Jerome's.
One.
It was black.
Tim, do you know anything about that David Shealy?
No, the name sounds familiar, but I do not remember him. But if he was from down Batesburg, Leesville, there's about 200 million Shealys down there.
Yeah, I was wondering if he had anything to do with Shealy's barbecue.
One of the Shealy brothers.
Well, it could have been. I don't know. Could have been.
Anyway, that's the way it was, guys.
Columbia
was
dirt.
One.
That was... Yep. You know, looking at that Bud Moore number 957 Chevrolet, one thing that really jumps out at me is how narrow the tires were.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And we thought they was wide.
Yeah, back then you did.
We thought that was wide.
They were wide for the day, but today's standards, they were really narrow. They weren't much wider than street tires.
They weren't. But I remember thinking how wide those were.
Yeah, because you wanted to try to find a couple to put on the back of your car just so you could have some wide tires.
Yep, good times.
Go ahead.
No, I'm done. This brings us up to the legendorial.
Tim, take it on, man.
Okay, we'll take it on, except there's no written legendorial tonight. This is just off the top of my head as we go along, because this has been a really wild week for me since Sunday, actually. But I started off when NBC announced they had a sellout, and Patrick covered this very well last night on his show. But when they announced they had a sellout, there were huge empty spaces in the grandstand. So that was the first thing I posted that ticked off half the world and got a lot of direct emails, a lot of comments, a lot of tweets and everything else going on that one. So then another one, I think Randy Myers, someone I deeply admire and respect, also got in. He wrote a blog for the website right here called What Is Wrong with NASCAR from the Eyes of an Old Fart / Fan. And, you know, I had to stop and think about that, and I started considering a lot of the things that he said in a follow-up reply to something that I had written. I think Bobby also had written there, but Randy replied to that about embracing what's going on and trying to accept it. Okay, Randy, you got me again. You pulled that on me with the NASCAR Hall of Fame, and I got it. And, you know, you and I have been there several times together. But I'm sure everybody here probably remembers that we had a civil war back in 1860s, and on a November day at a field in Gettysburg, Abraham Lincoln was talking about exactly what that war meant. So I'm going to paraphrase a little bit of that speech and say, 49 years ago, Big Bill France, along with several others, brought forth a sanctioning body to sanction stock car racing in the Southeast. What Big Bill wrought was something that was certainly needed to bring the sport up in the world, even though the Association of the Moonshine was still at that time acceptable, but over this period of time has gone away. But let's forget that. Let's just talk about what Randy said. Randy said that you need to embrace what NASCAR is trying to do and get NASCAR back on the upswing. Randy, I agree with that because I don't want to see anything happen to the sport. Now, I can almost accept every bit of that with no question. Anything I can do to help it along, I certainly will. But at the same time, I think NASCAR needs to learn to bend just a little bit, because so many of the fans out there are not buying into this playoff system. The thing with the points that nobody can seem to figure out, especially me, who has the worst record in math that has ever been recorded. But I don't know where it's going to go. I do not want to see it die. Now, apparently, from what I understand, there are even a couple of owners throwing forth the point that, you know, it's becoming impossible to sustain what NASCAR was and improbable to project what NASCAR will be. I know out of a 40-car starting field, they've had several, including this past Sunday's race, with 37 or 38 cars showing up. And I can remember very well, and I'm sure all of you can, when they would show up at Darlington, there would be 50 or 60 cars trying for 43 spots back then. Same at Daytona in February. 60 or 70 cars would show up to try for 43 spots. So, Randy, if you're listening tonight, I agree with what you say. We need to, and I especially, need to learn to try to embrace what's going on. But at the same time, I need a little bit of concession from NASCAR, which I'm sure I'm never going to get, to say, we appreciate what you've done over 66 years of spending your hard-earned money to be at these racetracks all over the place. And I was fortunate enough to work in commercial radio from 1974 through basically 2004. And so I got free press credentials and free tickets for my family and free parking for the motorhome everywhere we went. And that was all the races at Daytona, Talladega, Darlington, Charlotte, Rockingham, and a couple at North Wilkesboro, a couple at Bristol, and those things. But Randy, I'm with you, buddy. What you need to tell me what we need to do, because you're the man that knows all this. As you say, you're an old fan. I think I'm probably as old as you are, although I don't know that for a fact. But I'm with you. You tell me what we need to do, and we'll join forces and see where we can go with that. But thank you, Randy, for your understanding and patience. Back to you, Jeff.
Thank you, Timothy.
You're welcome.
Hugh, you're next.
Timothy B. Smith. Well, I have some musings about stuff, just lines of stuff. Why is it that the 58 Chevrolet has become such a wildly collectible item?
It's the ugliest car ever made.
I'll agree with you.
Nah, it's not the ugliest, but it's close.
It's close.
I think 58 was the ugliest car, was the ugly car year.
It was.
It was.
Almost everything of 58. I don't know what happened then. Maybe it was something in the water.
The metal was thin. There was god-awful gobs of chrome, and the designers must have been on crystal meth. I don't know what it was.
Whatever they had back then.
Whatever they had
back whatever
then.
Whatever it was, yeah.
I mean, the chrome literally just fell off of the things. Just musings. Tim said something about the poor car showings. I read somewhere recently that Watkins Glen only had 36 cars show up. That's unbelievable to me that in this sport that has been so wildly popular for all these years, that you can't get 36 cars to show up for a field. That's terrible. Silly season is upon us.
Matt Kenseth is out.
Yeah, Matt Kenseth is out. Lil E is out. Casey Kane is out.
Kurt
Kyle
Busch
Larson has lost his sponsor. Ryan Blaney, he's going to Penske. Paul Menard is going to Wood Brothers. Keselowski's staying. Fancy that.
If Busch doesn't kill him.
Well.
And Kurt Busch is out.
Yep.
Hey, when's the last time the Daytona 500 winner lost his ride in mid-season?
Yeah.
It might have happened before, but I can't think of an example.
I'll tell you, this is going to be a really roller coaster, the last of this year and the first of next year. But finances, I think, has finally caught up with the ball rolling down the hill. And I predict that we're going to see some really radical changes by the first of the next racing season. It's obvious that salaries are going down for the drivers, and I feel like that the very next thing that's going to happen is a lot of these high-dollar crew members, whether they're engineers or right front tire changers or whatever they might be, I have an idea that you're going to see a big drop in salaries. Because the money just appears to not, the sponsorship money just appears not to be there anymore. And it's easy to see why. The sponsors see the miserable crowds and the poor TV ratings. Why would they spend money?
I think
NASCAR's in for a really rude awakening.
Well, the next really big rude awakening is going to be after the Monster Energy drink contract runs out.
Well, that and some of these TV contracts run out.
Yeah,
I think they got a ways to go on the TV, unless there's a performance clause.
10 years, wasn't it?
Yeah, but there's bound to be a performance clause. It may take them out sooner than that.
Or may adjust it downward, possibly.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Cody.
I was just going to say, I'm going to predict, and I've been saying this for the last 2 years, within 10 years, I would say there's going to be another organization to step up to compete with NASCAR, or NASCAR is just going to fold. I mean, I just think that they're trying so hard to try and put their product out there, but, you know, like we all know, just nobody's interested anymore, so...
Nobody's interested at that price.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's price.
That's part of the problem. The price, the cost of racing, and you know that price that's on big league racing right now is just out of range. The audience for it is, they lost that. You know, they lost us, and thought they could get the young audience. The young people just aren't into cars.
Yeah.
You know,
Who knows, like I've said before, you know, a lot of people can't relate to the new people, the new generation of NASCAR. You know, you can't go out and relate to somebody that, you know, gets paid how much ever millions of dollars just to drive a car when, you know, back even 20 years ago, you still had people that worked on their own cars and they still kind of led somewhat of a regular life during the week. And, you know, a lot of people I don't feel like can relate to these drivers anymore. As one of their own.
Good point.
The young folks don't relate to the stars or the cars, and the old folks don't want to accept them.
Which, I mean, you look at Earnhardt. You know, he win a race on Sunday, and he'd feed his cows on Monday. Here again, win a race on Sunday, and he'd be building houses on Tuesday. You know, I just don't feel like anybody has your personalities enough to relate to your general working class person. So.
I think there was a school of thought that someone said, well, people will look up to them even more if we portray them as really jet setters with, you know, yachts and this and that and the big house and the ranch in Wyoming and the Learjet, and maybe that will make people look up to them even more. I think, you know, I'm with you, Cody. I really don't think that has worked.
I don't think it has.
It has not endeared the classic fan.
They lost touch with the fan the root fan, the grassroots fan.
There was a time if you were standing around talking racing and somebody happened to walk by and hear it, almost 90% of the people would stop to listen and most of them would stop to contribute to the conversation. Yeah. But just last weekend, when I was down in Augusta, a couple of us were talking about racing and everything that went on in Augusta and everything that happened there with stock cars. And there was a whole group of people around us that had absolutely no clue what we were talking about. And even worse, no interest whatsoever in hearing anything about it.
So I was sitting on a golf hole in Orlando this week shooting video. And a gentleman, African-American gentleman, yelled at me and he said, "Did you get that shot?" And I said, "Yeah, man, I got it." He said, "Good, you need a brother in that video." And I said, "Yes, I do." I said, "I'm gonna get some more of you too." Well, as he came off the course and he stopped by my cart and to speak to me, and I introduced myself, he introduced himself, and I said, "Where are you from?" His name was Al, and he said, "I'm from Novi, Michigan." I said, "Yeah, I know where Novi's at." He said, "How do you know where Novi's at?" I said, "Well, I'm a car guy and I'm a race fan." And I said, "Everybody knows about Novi and Bobby Unser's Novi engines and that connection and that kind of thing." And he said, "You're a race fan?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "NASCAR?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I was." He says, "Man, I was a huge fan." And I stood there and had the exact same conversation with him that we're having here. Mm-hmm. It's not related to just us, okay? Yeah. Anyone who became a fan during the era of whether it was 50s, 60s, and 70s, or 60s, 70s, and 80s, or 70s, 80s, and 90s in there, feel the same way that we're all talking about. Okay, so we're all not wrong. All right, I don't care what anybody says. We're not the ones that were wrong with that. Okay, they went off track. They blew it.
Yep.
And, I'm sorry that they're having a trouble trying to fix it. But I've never seen anything in life that grew that big that you could constrict.
Yep.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It will absolutely collapse before, or somebody's going to come along and ratchet it down. In its current state, those people can't cut that cost back. How do you stop that? It would take 15 years if they started today to try to get it back to that. It's not going to happen.
Know,
it's not natural. It doesn't happen.
But you know the
owner of Richard Petty Motorsports has approached NASCAR about putting a cap on what it costs to run a race team. He just did that, I think, last week.
So let's talk about something else. January the 25th next year marks Racers Reunion's 10-year anniversary.
Woo-hoo!
Okay,
I didn't know I was that old.
So we're celebrating all of 2018 and thereon, everything that we've done for 10 years. So April 25th, 2019 will be the 10-year anniversary of the first Columbia Speedway Racers Reunion. So we are planning to have another Columbia Speedway Racer, a 10th anniversary Columbia Speedway Racers Reunion. I've already talked to the Speedway guys. and we're looking at starting early, looking at ways to fund it so that we can have another huge free event car show. Just, you know, get it, whatever drivers we can get out there and have a big event. So be thinking about that, and be thinking about how to make that 10th anniversary really special. There's been a lot of water under the bridge happen in 10 years. We were talking about possibly – we started talking about having another racers reunion over 6, 7, 8 months ago. And I've come to this conclusion, with a 10-year anniversary that close, a year and a half away, doesn't make sense to have another one now. So yep, we're just going to plan on having that 10th anniversary and try to have a major blowout. We want to do it all just like we did before. We want to go down there and rent an entire hotel, fill it up with people, and have a moonshine jam at night. You know, I mean, I'd like to make that happen. So we're going to contact all of our old sponsors there, and we're going to be doing it as Salt Air Foundation. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, so we can run the event that way and raise money for Salt Air Foundation. So that gives us access to other buckets of funding to market it and get people in there. So yeah, so that's that. What do y'all think?
I think it'd be great. And I think you need to get some local TV talent like Rick Henry, or who's a race fan, or somebody like that to help with the sponsorship or help with the publicity for it.
They did a great job for us when we first did it. Those guys did. You know, everybody bought into that. And I've never really seen a community anywhere else that I've been that really cared that much about what happened at that old racetrack and what it meant to the community. Everybody came out and supported that effort.
Yeah.
You know?
Of course, a lot of people that were there then have died off.
So. I know, yeah. I mean, yeah, from driver interviews, yeah. I mean, Buddy Baker's gone, Little Bud's gone. I don't know who else.
Is Sam Summers still living?
I think so. I think Sam Summers is still alive.
He was a big Columbia guy in the late
60s. Yeah, huge. Yep. Harry Gantt's still living. He was huge in Columbia.
Yep. Harry came in 2010, I think.
Harry just did a big appearance at Hickory this weekend, along with Jack Ingram.
Yes, and Ned Jarrett and a bunch of them at the Cars Jarrett, race at Hickory Speedway, which was a major, major success. Throwback cars. It was.
Yeah.
Ned Jarrett made the comment on TV that it's been a long time since they saw the grandstand that full at Hickory, so you know that meant that it was full.
So we need to all band together again as we all did then. We didn't even know each other then, you know, when we started.
Not
all
really.
That. We just
it all started at your Christmas party.
Yep.
The Columbia Speedway reunion.
Yep, it did.
I think it was over that moonshine.
Yeah, might have been. Might have been.
But we went in that second room and we were looking at it on Google Earth, looking at the old track.
Yep, I remember it. Remember it well.
That's where it started.
I remember that. Yep. I do.
Jeff used to have some big parties back in the day.
Yeah, Jeff quit having parties.
Jeff went broke.
Spent all his money on parties.
Back in the
day. I used to be able to have some parties. We need to have another party, though. You know, we need to figure out how to do that.
Then you had one at a restaurant one time. Remember that one?
Yep.
There was two at your house.
Yep. We had one up here at the Caravelle.
Yep.
Remember that?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Yep. That was cool.
They were all
before
my time.
You know, I still get emails from them.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do. Telling me about their special events and blah, blah, blah.
We ought to see if we could put together something this year. I'd like to have a 10-year anniversary of the Christmas party.
Yeah, there you go.
Let's do that.
Sounds like a good
excuse to me.
Hey, next year.
Yeah, that'd be next year. That'd be next Christmas.
Oh, we got to wait a whole other year.
So we could have a party to plan the 10-year.
A pre-party.
You have a pre-party.
Yeah, we have to go back in that same room and turn on Google Earth.
We can do that.
Look
it's still
at
there.
It again.
Yeah, man.
That's where it all started.
Yep.
We could invite the Russians.
We could do that.
They
own half Myrtle Beach as it is.
No, that's the Chinese.
Chinese.
Well, the Russians own them.
Russians just work here.
What did you say, Bobby?
Think of all the vintage stuff, not just the racing, but that's happened since in the last 10 years.
That's what I was thinking about. If we start next year, think about all the occurrences and things that happened. We need to document when the Bell and Bell thing started, all those things that started as a result of this group here. You know, there's another major milestone in 2018, too, and I still say this is bigger than we think. We don't get a lot of credit for this. We streamed the first ever live race on the internet July the 18th, 2008, from Nashville. Think about
that's
that.
That's right,
guys.
Because I was trying to watch that, and it was getting. I saw most of it, but there was a couple of times I lost feet.
Yep, it was people just as big as black eye I've probably had since I've been in the business because I didn't think about people not being able to watch it.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, the streaming's a lot better now.
Yeah. You know, we didn't actually do it literally, but I think a lot of our momentum and enthusiasm caused things like the vintage parade at Daytona.
Yep.
I think just the
well, I think
the,
we
the,
added
the snowball downhill.
Kind of yeah, we've generated a lot of interest
like that.
For
well,
stuff
the,
like
the,
that.
The whole intent behind Racers Reunion was to help elevate all that,
and
you know?
That's been very successful.
And we with one of the first places we went was that that group. I'm trying to think what the Legends of Auto Racing or whatever they are down there in Daytona.
Living Legends.
Living
of
Legends.
Racing.
That's where I met Dargan Watts.
Yeah.
But they didn't know who we were, and they let us in. Then they shunned us after that. Yeah. I guess they were afraid we were going to take some of the spotlight away or something. I don't know what happened to that.
They
deal.
Used to. There's a page called, it's old as the hills, called Dirt Fans Forever. It's and the, I found that way back in the day. And Dargan Watts and Jim Skinner had a
is
million
it still up?
Picture. Yeah, Dirt Fans 101 or something like
Hi.
That.
Yeah, I've
it's
seen
a,
that.
Yeah, and it's green. It's green and black. It's all the writing, but it's got pictures of. All yep. kind of, and Dargan Watts. That was my first introduction. Him and Jim Skinner had a picture of everybody and his brother on that side.
I didn't realize they did that.
But we need to be thinking
they
about
they
all
just
those
contributed
things.
To it.
Oh, contributed. Okay. Yeah,
all those it. Things that happened since we started this deal, and let's make note of them as we move forward. Because starting next January, we've got milestones coming up. One right
what
after
What about
another.
One of our greatest things that never. Came to fruition was the Shelby thing.
Yes.
Yep.
That was a man. That was.
That's 2012.
Yep.
That had so much going for it, and it somehow it all.
Yep.
Everything fell through the cracks.
No, well, that was all the insurance company's fault, was it not?
Well, it wasn't the insurance company's fault. It was the fairgrounds' fault for not having insurance. I mean, the insurance company would not. I couldn't get an insurance company to insure the event because it didn't have a catch fence.
And they wouldn't put a catch fence.
And they wouldn't put a catch fence.
I mean, that was the issue. They would not make the grounds insurable.
Yeah, that's it, exactly.
So if you ain't going to do that, then...
And when that ended up there, I'll bet you if you could research into that, when it came time to renew that insurance policy, I bet that's when the racing stopped up there. That'd be my guess. But I don't know. They're not. Last I heard, they weren't. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just guessing because, dude, I called everybody. No one... in the industry would insure that race without a catch fence unless the racetrack was 150 feet or yards or something away from the fans. You could not insure it with that racetrack right up against the grandstands like that.
Well, how is it that all these little local tracks get away without having catch fences in the same situation?
They've all got catch fences. I don't know a track anywhere that don't have catch fence.
Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah. I haven't been on a racetrack ever that didn't have a catch fence except that one. And I can tell you, Mike Sykes flagged that race, and I got up on the flag stand with him. That's a scary thing when you think about what could happen there.
Yep.
You know? So, all right, we got to get out of here. Anyway, good stuff coming. 10th year anniversary right around the corner. Thanks, everybody, for putting this thing together. We appreciate you. Thanks to all you fans that let us be part of your Tuesday. We appreciate you, too. Thanks to all the men and women that serve our military so that we can do this. To each and every one of you, good night, and God bless all of you.
Racing through history.